And we are at the home of Edwin Flowers in Sun City West, Arizona. We are here doing an oral history interview, and this is for the Bird Polar Research Center Archival Program, funded by the National Science Foundation. Mr. Flowers, can you tell us what attracted you to a career as a meteorologist?
I'd have to say it's mostly by chance. I went in the Navy when to actually avoid the draft at the end of World War II. After boot camp, we were given assignments, and mine happened to be as a weather person. I wasn't a meteorologist, I was simply a observer of weather, that sort of thing. Went to school in Lakehurst, New Jersey, spent my Navy career, which was only about 18 months, doing weather work. And when I got out, I wanted to continue. It seemed like a neat kind of job. Wanted to go to Penn State University, but they were full up. That was the way things were after the war. And then my next contact with meteorology was at the end of my college, undergraduate college. I needed a job. I was trained as a secondary education teacher. I wasn't exactly keen on it, but I had a wife and a child, so I needed a job, and it turned out that there was a notice on the bulletin board at college for tests to join the Weather Bureau, and I took it, and I got heard from them, and within a few months, we moved to Washington, D.C., and that was the start of my meteorology career.
Okay, very good.
Rather chancy, but that's the way it was.
How did you get involved with the International Geophysical Year? Did you volunteer to go to Antarctica, or how did that all take place?
Yeah, I did volunteer. My boss at the time, I was working with the Scientific Services Division of the Weather Bureau in Washington, D.C., and my boss was Harry Weckler, who was a wheel in the planning for the IGY. We were a small group, the Scientific Services Division, so I knew my boss rather well, and I volunteered, and he was quite happy that I did, and simple as that.
Can you tell me what your duties were during your time in Antarctica?
Well, I was the chief meteorologist at South Pole Station. We had three other fellows in our meteorology group, and our duties were pretty well spelled out by the IGY plans for the science duties in the Antarctic. We took weather observations hourly basis, transmitted these to whoever, I suppose, McMurdo. We took balloon soundings, called Raven sounds, every 12 hours. We made measurements of the energy exchanges between the surface in the atmosphere with during the summer months with sunlit months. We used something called a pyranometer, measured sunlight. During the winter with an instrument that measures the long wave exchange. Collected snow samples. Routine meteorological work. It was strictly, almost strictly an observing program. There was no research on our part. And of course, we were always involved with the activities at the camp.
Such as?
Such as digging snow for water, washing dishes. We all took our turns at that. Whatever it took to keep the station going.
Okay. How many weather stations, like observation stations, were there?
I think that...
Do you know?
I believe the U.S. had six stations.
Okay.
And I really can't tell you how many other nations were involved, but there were probably dozens of other nations involved.
Okay.
I think Russia was probably the other country that had the most stations. They had three or four.
Can you tell us if the Antarctica had your work in Antarctica influenced your career? Did it influence your career?
I think it did, because I did stay in the polar work for about 10 years after that, doing research and actually getting involved in another year in the Antarctic in 1960 and spending two other summers there. Working with a polar group in Washington, D.C., we did research, but one part of it also had to do with coordinating programs with the in the North Polar regions with the Canadians. And later on came the IQSY, which was the International Quiet Zone Year, and we had a part in that, designing programs for Antarctica and for the Arctic. And I said I stayed with it about 10 years, and so in that sense it had a great influence. And I think also it probably steered me into an area known as energy budget studies. And from that, that actually was my whole career in the Weather Bureau.
So it had a big influence, really.
Big influence, yes.
Mm-hmm. What can you tell us about interactions between the naval personnel and civilian scientists in Antarctica?
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. You may have heard this from other people you've talked to. At least during the IGY, the Navy provided the support. These were mostly Seabees. At South Pole, there were 9 Seabees and 9 civilians, I believe. Boy, what a... it's been too long. At first, it was arm's length. I think they thought of us as special people who were going to go about their scientific duties, but otherwise not to be associated with. We weren't respected, I'd say that. But it didn't take long when they found out that we could dig snow and wash dishes and all the other camp duties. When they found out that we did those just as well as they did and without grumbling, that sort of thing. For the most part, most of them came over and we had great friends among the Navy people. I think they learned to respect us. We respected them for what they did. There were some incidents, of course, that was bound to happen. I don't think it was strictly a civilian scientist interaction. It was more personalities than it was antagonism between the fact that we were civilians and they were. I think there was a little resentment on their part, too, because they were being paid their regular, whatever they were paid, which wasn't very much. Perhaps there was a bonus for them. And they saw us as earning a great deal more money and not doing a heck of a lot more. So I suppose that was always part of the antagonism when there was antagonism.
Okay. What have been some of the significant changes in the field of meteorology during your career?
Oh my. I've been away from it for 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
I may have to think about that, but certainly satellites changed the way weather observing has been done. Also, the government involvement in weather activities has changed. It's spread over many organizations like NASA as being one, but there are many others. It's not just a single weather bureau as it was when I first joined. The Weather Bureau was a very small organization then. Very small and compact. Almost every city of any size in the country had a weather station. That's gone now. Automatic weather stations have taken over. Many places the work is done by contract, not by government personnel. But I think scientifically the satellite was probably the biggest change and also the introduction of computers to aid and hasten and speed up the forecasting capabilities. I'm not sure we get any better forecasts, but it looks better.
What do you see as the most important accomplishments of your professional career? And this can be, you know, generally speaking, as well as narrowed to what you feel was important when you were in Antarctica. What was the important things?
Oh, my. I'm not sure I can even list anything that was significant that I was involved in. Later in my career, we were involved with the Solar Energy Research Program. And I think we made a good contribution in providing more accurate measurements of solar energy that are necessary in such programs. We put the measurement of solar energy on a sound basis Before, it was rather just a program where they made measurements. They weren't too concerned about accuracy. They may have been, but they weren't doing it very accurately. We got good standards and maintained them, had a firm calibration program. Of course, this required the infusion of money, and that was available when the solar energy program was put into place. So I think that if there's one contribution I would point to, it was that.
When we talk about accomplishments, then sometimes that leads us to think about maybe things that disappointed us in our career or projects. Can you think of anything that was disappointing to you or anything you wish had been done differently?
I don't think I can list any disappointments.
Okay.
Perhaps, towards the end of our career, and I think this would apply to anybody who worked for the federal government, there was a change in attitude of the public towards the people who worked for the U.S. government. When I first joined the Weather Bureau, it was rather a proud moment. I think my parents and Louise's parents, my wife's parents, really thought it was pretty neat to have a member of the family as part of the federal government. But as years went on, a federal employee got less and less respect. I've used that term a lot, I guess. And towards the last years of my career, it was mostly during, if I can get a little political here, during the Reagan years, when a federal employee was really disparaged. He was looked down on. It was almost an embarrassment to tell people that, yeah, I worked for the U.S. government. So if there's a disappointment, it might be in how we were viewed by the public or by public officials. And I think we were all mostly very honorable people who did a good job and worked hard. So if that's a disappointment, that might be it. I said I didn't have any, and then I can go on and on.
Well, usually when you start to think about it, you can come up with...
Yeah, I think so.
You know, when you think about it. Actually, that's very interesting concept.
I've heard other people say the same thing.
It's too bad, actually. Do you have any kinds of documentation or other things from when you were in Antarctica?
What would documentation be?
Oh, things like maybe if you kept a journal or... if you had any kind of memorabilia from when you were there, photos or...
Oh, yeah, there are things like that. I think about 6 months ago, Louise dug out these several boxes that we have that contain Antarctic materials, letters and... what else? You can pipe in here. You're the one who put it together. She wanted a... Before we expired, I think she wanted to put some of it into some kind of coherent form. And so she put together little scrapbooks of some of the materials. And I guess they're mostly letters, I suppose. And we have things that were signed by many of the people who were in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. Quite a few photographs. Probably some of them are unique in the sense... my second tour in 1960, the Russians came overland and visited the South Pole. And we have a couple of pieces of Well, we have a statue of the Mona, no, of Venus de Milo, Milo, yeah. The Venus de Milo that one of the Russians gave me. In fact, his name was Kapitsa. He spoke English with a British accent. His father was known as the father of the atomic bomb in Russia. He was an atomic scientist in Russia. And this young man was his son, and we traded things between the tractor party and ourselves. And the strange thing that he had with him was this false marble replica of the Venus de Milo. Rather strange thing to carry on a tractor. But in the years when the Russian, when the Communist Party was falling apart in Russia, this young man, he's no longer a young man, Kapitsa was a spokesman for, let me say he was on television a number of times, I suppose because of his good command of English, for one thing. But he was explaining what was going on in Russia, and it was kind of unusual to see this man who I had met 1960, I suppose, or 59, I believe, at such a remote place of the world.
Actually,
and we have some photographs of the Russians with at the South Pole and their tractors, this sort of thing.
You've got some covers, letter covers from them,
signed. Yeah.
How much stuff do you think you have? I'm just, you know,
there's a box of
one box,
about
a box. Just gives us an idea.
Plus a bunch of other stuff in here.
Miscellaneous, kind
of. I kept journals for short periods of time, but they're virtually worthless because they didn't cover a very long period.
But he was a good letter writer. He did
tell you what was going on. And,
yeah.
And that's kind of interesting when you look back on
yes.
that. I didn't really ask you this. I didn't have this on the list of questions, but I was thinking about it now as we were talking. Could you give us an idea of like what a typical day would have been for you when you were there?
Yeah, probably so. There were four of us in the meteorology group, and I was simply one of the members, even though I was in charge of them, but I felt it. I should be around for both balloon launches every 12 hours, so my day would start either with a balloon launch and be around the office and making weather observations. I usually kept the same schedule as most people in camp. In other words, I had breakfast at the usual time and lunch and dinner, but then I usually stuck around for the last balloon launch of the day. If it was a, the civilians, I think, worked for a week at a time doing dishes, and we, two of us at a time would do it, doing dishes and cleaning up after each meal. So if that was our duty, we always spent about an hour doing that. And I can't recall how much time we were asked to spend digging snow for water. We had a snow mine. Eventually it ended up about 80 or 90 feet below the surface. And when I say dig for snow, it wasn't really snow as you normally think about it. It was more like using an ice axe, chipping away at rock almost. It was flinty hard. It was cold, of course. So if that was maybe once a week or twice a week, you'd do that. They were asking us, Paul Seipel asked us to put so many hours in doing that. You know, you haven't asked me about Paul Seipel.
I think we need to talk about
that. Because he's an icon, I think.
Exactly, he certainly is.
I think he was, I kind of get choked up when I talk about him. I think he was the finest man I've ever known. And if you can spend a whole year with a man and still have those thoughts about him, that's...
Especially in a remote place.
That's a special person, yeah. Although we didn't see each other that much in the station. The station was almost two camps. We had sleeping quarters for most of the Navy people, all the Navy people, us four meteorology people, and Moose Remington, another scientist. We had sleeping quarters for that group. And then Paul Seipel and Jack Tuck, and let's see, I think three others of the science, or four others of the science people, were about three buildings away. And that was their sleeping quarters. And they spent a good deal of their time at the far end of the camp at the what was called the science building. The rest of us spent most of our time around the mess hall, because that's where the med office was, where most of the Navy people congregated. So we saw Paul at lunchtime, at dinner time. We'd have movies a couple times a week. We had discussions, discussion groups. They may have started out first as church services, but that didn't last very long. We had discussion groups, so I didn't see him as much as I'd see many of the other Navy people and the other meteorology people, but we saw him a lot. And he really was a very special person, a great leader, in the sense that he would never get down on anyone, and he certainly had reason to do it if he wanted to. He would see the best in everyone. If he talked to somebody about a problem, it was always from the viewpoint that, say, you're doing fine, maybe in this area you might think about this or that, or this sort of thing. After talking to him, I'm sure everybody felt a little bit better. If Paul called somebody in because he thought he was screwing up, he wouldn't tell him that. He wouldn't say, hey, you're fouling up, you're going to have to straighten things out. I wasn't there when he did this, but I just know this is his way. And so in that sense, I think he was a tremendous leader. And I don't know how other people viewed him his other years in Antarctica, but I don't know a single person who didn't have a great deal of respect for him. Everyone. We may have disliked another member or had that sort of thing, but Paul was just, he was just a different person.
Did you have any contact with him after you came back?
Yeah, we did. We got together a few times, and he was always so kind and generous, and in his when he talked about you. Now, you didn't feel it was just putting you on. He wasn't just stroking you. He was genuine in his feelings. At least, yeah, he was genuine in his feelings.
We still have contact with his wife.
Yeah, his wife is still living. Mm-hmm. And she writes to us birthdays and anniversaries. And he went off to New Zealand or Australia, I'm not sure which, as a science attaché, and
Australia.
He never came back. He came back in a box. And
no, he got sick over there.
And we went.
He had a heart attack over there.
Yeah. I believe he was 51 or somewhere around that age when he was at the pole.
Oh.
Which made him nearly 20 years older than the oldest of us. I don't know how. There were a group of us around 29, 30, 31, 32, somewhere in that age group.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were a number of much younger fellows. In fact, Mel Havener, I think, wasn't even 20.
Wow.
I guess if there's another fellow I'd want to talk about, it would be Mel Havener.
Mm-hmm.
He was the mechanic. He was the last minute addition to the pole group because the man who had been selected by the Navy to be the mechanic at the pole station hurt his back during the building period, and they shipped him out, and Mel came in on the very last plane. And he was responsible for keeping the tractor and the, well, the two tractors going. But he was also responsible for keeping the generators going. And that was our, without generators, you're in real trouble. You wouldn't have lights. Well, you wouldn't have electricity. You couldn't do a science program. You wouldn't have lights. Some of the heat would be gone because some of the stoves had electric blowers. So he was a really vital person. He was young. He was kind of crude in some ways. I don't mean to disparage him by saying that. And he rubbed some people the wrong way, but really a highly capable person. And I think, well, probably one of the more important people in camp.
Can you think of anyone else that you would like to mention about?
Well, I could say nice things about almost all of them, and that's really the meteorology group we had was just, they were just top notch. Herb Hansen and Floyd Johnson and John Guerrero. John was a young fellow. He and I went into the poll, I think January 7th of 1958. We were the first civilians, besides Paul. Paul was there. Mm-hmm. We were the first to go in. John was only about 21 or 22. He had spent some time in Alaska. He came in wearing an Eskimo parka, a very garish thing. Underneath it, he had a Hawaiian, short-sleeve Hawaiian shirt. So he was immediately an oddity. And I'm not sure how the Navy people looked on him, but I don't think he very favorably, but he was a good guy. He kept our equipment running. He was the electronic technician for us. So he did his job under some very harsh conditions. And the other civilians, we got along just great. We had some contact with Arlo Landolt. He was a young man too, I think about 21 or 22. He was an astronomer, and he ran the what program did he run? Aurora program, my goodness. And he went on to get a doctorate in astronomy. And we met him a few years ago down at Kitt Peak Observatory here in Arizona. He invited us to come down and look at the telescopes. He had a week or 2 week window where he could work down there. So we've had some contact with him, but that was mostly through his efforts. We stayed in touch with Mel Havener. We stayed in touch with Floyd Johnson for some period of time, and Herb Hansen. So those associations have always been pleasurable.
Can you think of anything else that I should have asked you right off the top of your head?
I haven't got much on the top of my head. But. Actually, I don't think about Antarctica very much. Mm-hmm. When you called, I think it started a period when I was thinking about it a lot, and I don't do that. It's in the past. I don't regret it. Obviously, I don't. I enjoyed my period there, and I must have enjoyed it because I went back three more times. But what's past is past, I guess.
Have you enjoyed thinking back on it?
Beg your pardon?
Have you enjoyed having a reason to think back to that time?
Oh, I suppose so. Because they're pleasant memories. There's nothing unpleasant at all about it. It's, again, I suppose it's just something that's in the past. I enjoy my life now, and that's my life.
Well, I can't think of anything myself that I want to ask right now, so I think that puts us at the end if you don't have anything more you want to add at this moment.
No, I suppose we could talk on and on, but I'm not much of a talker. Must be an awful interview. But,
no, you've done.
I know you're
going to
say
job.
It's been good.
It has been good.
But I find it awkward talking about myself in my life. I really do.
I think you've done a very good job. Thank you very much.
Okay.